Dark Side of the Ring returned last week with the Plane Ride from Hell episode, and the fallout was swift for Ric Flair and Tommy Dreamer. Dreamer, for his bizarre defense of Flair and just the way he came off, was disturbing. And as a result, he was suspended from Impact Wrestling. He was booted from his part-time hosting gig on Busted Open Radio. Flair apologized for behaving like a jackass over the years and waving his dick around, blaming it on the booze, but adamantly denied ever having forced himself on anyone. And if he was going to be showing up in AEW soon, he surely will not be now. WWE has removed all of his merchandise from WWE shop, including this new, it was like a blue championship belt with Flair plates on them. They literally just came out with this thing. Everything has been stripped away from the website. And CarShield has suspended its ad campaign with him. You know, the real victim here is poor LA Knight. He was in those commercials too. He didn't do anything wrong. But this week, there was things were a lot more tame, with an episode on the double life of Chris Kanyon. I thought it was a solid episode. I learned a few things about him that I did not know going into it, which is always nice. A lot of times, you know, Dark Side of the Ring, I like it. It's a good show. But, you know, a lot of times it's just a dramatic retelling of stuff that a lot of us already know or stories that we've already heard. But he really was an innovator in the ring in ways that I never even really thought about, like actively thought about. Which is how he got the name The Innovator of Offense, which was a playoff of Tommy Dreamer's Innovator of Violence name. They showed him doing moves in the ring, juxtaposed to a lot of talent on the AEW roster today, friends of his like Brian Cage and the Young Bucks, doing those very same moves. Obviously having learned them from him and having been influenced by him. His influence is being felt today on television. I even saw them throw in a shot of a buckshot lariat that he once did in a match in WCW. And you know, I sometimes get questions about who was the most overrated wrestler of all time, who was the most underrated wrestler of all time. I don't know about all time, but when this episode was over, I realized how underrated Kanyon really was in the ring. I also didn't realize the depths of his mood swings and how violent he was with James Mitchell, who was the main talking head throughout this episode, the Sinister Minister, his old manager from WCW, James Vandenberg, back when Chris was playing the Mortis character. And he was also one of Chris's best friends. You know, this wasn't mentioned in the episode, but the two of them became friends in the early 90s as tape traders through issues of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And Chris is the one who got Mitchell his job with WCW. When he was doing the Mortis character, he wanted to bring him in and have him be his manager. So it was great to get his perspective and his insights on this. And he's just a great storyteller. They spoke with Diamond Dallas Page, Chris Jericho, Brian Cage, the Young Bucks, Luke Hawks, all of whom were friends with Kanyon, very good friends of his. Two people they did not interview, and I'm not sure why, other than maybe just lack of time, because they only have an hour for these things. One person was Raven, who was very good friends with Chris, and he even tweeted that he could have added a lot of perspective to the episode. He isn't sure why he was never contacted. And Sharkboy, who credits Chris with discovering him on the indies and getting him a contract with WCW. You know, there's a famous dark match at a SmackDown taping in 2003 where Kanyon wrestled Sharkboy. And you can find it on YouTube. It's online. And the two of them tore it up. And the crowd was really into the match. And the match is only about 9 or 10 minutes. But it's a really good match. And he made Sharkboy look great. And when they got to the back through the curtain, he got chewed out by Arn Anderson. Because how is everybody else on the show now supposed to follow what you two guys just went out there and did in the dark match? But he was known for that. He was known for giving guys a lot in those matches, trying to help get them over as much as he could, even when he was supposed to just go in there and squash them. he wouldn't squash them. He would make it competitive, and there would be close near falls, and the fans were into it. But then he would get heat because it's not what the office wanted. You know, his whole attitude was, you know, if I go out there and my goal and my job is to give the people a great show and get them reacting and entertain them. And, you know, that wasn't always what his job was expected to be. And it would get him into trouble. But more than anything, when I reflect back on this episode, it's a sad story. It is a sad, depressing story of someone who loved pro wrestling, was a huge pro wrestling fan. He was very good at it. And when it wasn't there for him anymore, he couldn't cope because he had all of these other issues that plagued him throughout his career, which only got worse when he got released by WWE, and then independent stuff eventually dried up, and, you know, he had financial issues, and it all just built and built and built. And ultimately, in the end, it's what did him in. You know, part of the problem was that he struggled for years with depression and bipolar disorder, which went undiagnosed until many years later. So while he's going through all of this stuff and dealing with stuff that in some cases has not even been medically diagnosed yet, he is trying to keep his sexuality a secret. And he is paranoid that people are going to find out that he is a gay man. And that if that happens, he wouldn't be accepted in the wrestling business. He was in those locker rooms at a time where there was a lot of gay bashing going on. And people would crack jokes. And he feared that if they found out that he was gay, his career would be over. So you're struggling with your mental health while trying to keep this secret, while also dealing with all the typical bullshit that comes with being in the wrestling business. And I'm sure concussions were part of it as well. I'm sure he had many of them. There have been stories of him hitting his head in a match, at least one, in WCW, and then vomiting afterwards. Now, who knows how many times that happened? How many of those concussions went undiagnosed? And he was back wrestling the next day. What kind of impact does that have on the person's brain? A person without all of the issues that he had. He would have these, you know, these wild mood swings where one minute he would be okay and perfectly fine and nice, nicest guy in the world. And then the next minute, literally at one point, had his hands wrapped around Jim Mitchell's neck with his thumbs on his Adam's apple, choking him until he passed out unconscious. And then the next day he would just be fine and it was like nothing ever happened. All of this stuff was a recipe for disaster. They covered his time as Mortis in WCW. This was during the time where WCW brought in Glacier, who was a Sub-Zero ripoff from Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat was still the hot thing at that time. I always thought Mortis was a ripoff of Reptile. I'm pretty sure that's what he was supposed to be. All they needed was Scorpion. But I guess Sting probably would not have appreciated that very much if that happened. The Mortis mask and the whole getup with the skull. I mean, I love skulls. The whole Mortis mask and getup actually looked really cool. Shit, if they sent Karrion Kross to the ring wearing a skull helmet, I might be more open to his whole getup during his entrance. Skulls are cool. What's not to like about Skull? One of the reasons why I like Malachi Black, his whole entrance. He just looks badass when he walks out there. But the whole Mortis look was really cool. And he worked some house show matches as Mortis years later for WWE. There were photos of him in a purple Mortis outfit. So it wasn't the green one that he wore in WCW. This one was purple. And it ran in WWE magazine. This might have been around 2003, probably. But then it never went anywhere. They never let him be Mortis on TV. It was just a handful of house show matches. The problem with Mortis, and the reason it wouldn't have worked, even if they let him go on TV with it in 2003, it wouldn't have worked. The problem with Mortis was that it didn't fit at a time when wrestling was becoming more reality-based. And I say that, of course, fully aware of the existence of Kane and The Undertaker. But, I mean, it's Kane and The Undertaker. Chris Kanyon was not Kane and he was not The Undertaker. But even Kane and The Undertaker evolved their characters after the Attitude Era, early 2000s. You know, it wasn't so much about all the mystical, magical bullshit. you know, even they had to evolve. It's like adapt or die. So that character would not have worked, I don't think, in that era. And in this episode, they said that what did him in was that he was playing Mortis, and then along came the NWO in WCW, and that was the end of the character. It might have been DDP who even said he was having a conversation, and Chris said to him, once the NWO came in, Chris looked at him and said, oh, that's it. That's it. I'm dead. Their timeline was off, though. That doesn't make any sense, because he was playing Mortis after the NWO had already debuted. In fact, it was at least 6 months after the NWO debuted that Mortis even first debuted on television. And they made it sound like he was already a character, and then along came the NWO, and then he realized, oh my God, this doesn't jive with what WCW is doing now. I'm done. The character is done. And so their timeline here on this was all screwed up. But I think if the Mortis character, if Canyon as Mortis had come along with that gimmick in the early to mid-90s in WWE, or even mid-90s WCW when they were doing the Dungeon of Doom stuff, he would have had more success than he did. Because if Papa Shango worked main events in 1992 against the Ultimate Warrior, there's no reason to think that Mortis couldn't have been in that role. He came along with it 5 years too late, because he could work. Then maybe he would have been doing jobs for the big baby faces, but I think he would have had a lot more success had he come along with it 5 years earlier. One person who I think does not get enough credit for really doing right by Canyon was Eric Bischoff. You know, when the Mortis stuff fizzled out, they unmasked him and he started working as himself. He started working as Chris Canyon. I mean, Canyon's not his real name, but, you know, he was able to be himself a little bit more, right? He didn't have a mask on anymore. Metaphorically, he still did. He was still hiding a lot from people, but he joined Raven's flock after that. And then later on, he was part of the Jersey Triad with DDP and Bam Bam Bigelow. Bischoff made him a stunt guy on the set of Ready to Rumble. He had a lot of responsibilities with that movie. He helped train David Arquette. They trusted him with a lot of responsibility. They wouldn't have done that with just anybody. And Chris told the story in an RF video shoot interview years ago about once going to Bischoff about his pay and wanting to make more money. And Bischoff told him, give me a figure. He didn't know what to say. He had 3 seconds to think of something and just spit it out. And he gave him a figure. And I don't remember. It might have been, maybe it was, I don't know, $75,000 or $90,000 or something like that. And Bischoff looked at him and he said no. And then he offered him more than what he was asking for. He actually gave him more money. So, I mean, you hear stories about guys who didn't have a very positive experience with Eric Bischoff, and Eric Bischoff was kind of a dick, and I'm sure he was. But I also think, you know, in the interest of being fair, it's important to mention that there were other people who had the complete opposite experience, who would actually say that Bischoff treated them very well, and from, you know, all accounts, Canyon was one of those guys who always had, you know, never really a cross word to say about Eric Bischoff and the way he was treated in WCW. Now, they treated his time in WWE the way you would have expected. It was not a very positive time for him. Although when he came over initially as part of the invasion in 2001, at one point he was a double champion. He had, I think it might have been the WCW or WWE tag team titles. He had the WCW US title, which was handed to him. Booker T, I think, literally handed it to him, and he was the US champ. But then he got hurt, and he needed surgery. And then he got hurt again while he was out still recovering from that surgery. I think that was his shoulder the second time. I think it was his knee and then his shoulder. So he missed a very long time. He missed about 18 months. And his depression got really, really bad. And that's when he came back on SmackDown, the infamous segment where Undertaker opens this giant gift box and out comes Chris Canyon, dressed as Boy George, singing, "Do You Really Want to Hurt Me?" And Undertaker destroyed him and then gave him this sickening chair shot to the head. As hard of a chair shot to the head as you will ever see or hear. That's not the only time that Undertaker hit somebody that hard in the head with a chair. I think of the one to Mr. Kennedy years later. but there have been other people as well. But I think it's reasonable to wonder what the point of that segment was when you look back and you realize that they brought this guy back to television after a year and a half away, only to be embarrassed like that. And then they never did anything with him again. He was relegated to job matches on Velocity after that until they fired him in 2004. Now, he claimed that it might have been the company's way of sort of warning him not to come out of the closet. What, is this supposed to be some kind of symbolism, I guess? It's like that scene in The Sopranos where Phil Leotardo comes out of the closet when they've got Vito in the hotel room. Supposed to be symbolic, I guess. He talked about it like maybe it was a symbolic thing of trying to tell him, warn him, don't come out of the closet. And then later on, he claimed that he was fired by WWE for being gay, which was a lie. That's not true. And he admitted that it wasn't true. He told Jim Mitchell it wasn't true, and that he only said that in case he felt the need one day to sue them. I assume for wrongful termination, which he never did. But that Undertaker segment, you know, they interviewed Raphael Morphy for this episode as well. Morphy grew up with Chris in Sunnyside, Queens. They went to school together. Years ago, he worked in live events for WWE, had a great reputation. Later on, he worked for TNA. Today, he is the director of live events for AEW. In fact, Morphy is the one responsible for making the connections that got AEW into Arthur Ashe Stadium for Dynamite this week. He is credited with making that deal happen. So he's been around for a very long time, but he was also very good friends with Chris. He doesn't buy the idea. He doesn't believe that WWE is going to have somebody trained to come back for more than a year after being off television for more than a year just to bring them back for the purpose of humiliating them. He doesn't buy it. To which I say, this is a company filled with a lot of very petty people who I don't doubt for a second would do something like that. Now, is that what they did here to Canyon? I don't know. I mean, somebody got their rocks off with it when it was over. So is his career there. Like I said, they never did anything with him after it. So what was the point of even doing that segment with him? Why did it have to be him? It's not like he was playing this character after that on television. You could have gotten anybody. You could have brought in one of these local workers and paid him $50 and stuck him in a box. So I think there is something to the story that somebody had it out for this guy. Was it because he was gay? You know, he hadn't even come out of the closet at that point. He didn't go public. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't people in the company who knew or thought he was gay. Just because he didn't announce it publicly doesn't mean that there weren't people who were, you know, chirping behind the scenes. But let's assume not, because he didn't announce he was gay publicly until many years later. He was still a closeted man at that point. The reality is it was still a very shitty, awful way to treat this guy. Now, after he was gone from WWE, he started making appearances on the Howard Stern Show. Probably not the best place for somebody dealing with all of these mental health issues to be going is the Howard Stern Show. That's why I always said, like, Artie Lang. I mean, if you're a Stern fan, you remember the days of Artie Lang being on Howard Stern. And I wasn't listening to Howard Stern every day, but I would hear when I was, you know, commuting to work. I remember the first MP3 player I ever bought had an FM radio component to it, so I could listen to the radio. And Stern was still on K-Rock here in New York at that time. This is right before he went to satellite radio. And so I started listening on a more regular basis, not every day, but, you know, this is when Artie was on the show, and I always thought he was, you know, hilarious on the show. And, you know, it was never the same when he left. But there's a guy who has been plagued by fucking substance abuse issues and all kinds of shit his entire life. That was probably the worst place for someone like him to be. As destructive as he was, and as much of a compulsive liar as he was, and just being in that environment where they're always railing on you and cracking jokes on you and stuff, probably the absolute worst place for him to be working was on that show. So Canyon going on Stern, again, probably not the best idea in the world. And they included some of the clips here on the show. Ric Flair posted a preemptive apology on his Twitter before this episode even aired, figuring that he was not going to come out of this smelling like roses, especially after the week before. Because he called into one of Kanyon's appearances on Stern. He did so on behalf of WWE. They wanted to get Vince McMahon to come on the show. Vince was busy, or more likely was like, fuck this, I'm not going on here. So then they were going to get Triple H, and that didn't work out, so they ended up going with Flair. And Flair called into the show, and it was devastating. It was devastating to Kanyon because Flair called in basically to serve as the company stooge. Ric Flair was this man's idol growing up. He was the biggest Ric Flair fan in the world. And he was so excited to hear that, oh my God, Ric Flair is on the line. And Flair proceeded to talk about how the reason that he got fired was because he just wasn't any good. He wasn't good enough to be in WWE. He didn't have what it took to be a WWE superstar. And at one point, he talked about Kanyon's lifestyle choices, how he chose to be, and Kanyon piped up and said, it's not a choice. Obviously, Flair feels otherwise. Flair did not come off well at all in that segment. And he noted, oh, Chris is a great guy. I love Chris. It's like in one vein, he's saying, Chris is a great guy. I love Chris. But then in the next vein, he was no good. And you know, he noted that if he wasn't that good, or Kanyon did, it was noted that if I'm not that good, then how come you let me train your son in WCW? Because he had a hand in training David Flair. If I was no good as a worker, then why would you let me train your son? I think Flair was piggybacking off comments that John Cena had made on Stern's show. I want to say Cena's comments came first because he also got raked over the coals after this episode. Cena had been in studio with Howard on a different day. And Stern asked him about Kanyon, who had been fired by WWE. And Cena said that Kanyon just wasn't any good. And I think Flair was piggybacking off of those comments. But it was really, and Stern is to blame for this also, because Stern was really teeing it up and saying, you know, we had Chris Kanyon on the show, and he said he was fired by WWE because he was gay. And then he says to Cena, so what do you have to say about that? And if you're John Cena, you know, he came off terribly as well. But if you're John Cena, what are you supposed to do? You know, because you know this guy is out there. He's saying things about the company that in some cases are not true. That is not why he was fired by WWE. But he's obviously persona non grata. You've just been, you know, cornered with this question here. I think there is a diplomatic way to answer it and just say, you know, like he did. I know Chris for a long time. He's a good guy, but you know, obviously he's dealing with some issues right now and I don't know what he's going through, but I wish him all the best. That's really all he had to say. But instead he went off about how he's not really any good. The name of the company is WWE. You know, the E stands for entertainment and you have to have the entertainment part of it down. It's not just about your technical ability. Chris couldn't entertain in the way that WWE wanted him to entertain. That's basically what Flair said. And that's complete bullshit. Flair in his Twitter post admitted that he was holding the company line back then when he called in. He said he wasn't a huge fan of Kanyon as a worker, but he was a hell of a guy, he said. Cena's name was trending on Twitter for over 24 hours. People were, like I said, raking him over the coals, trying to cancel John Cena. There was a hashtag cancel Cena. Just the fucking dumbest shit. Cena was being a company stooge, just like Flair. Kanyon had the entertainment part of things down just fine. Was he ever going to be world champion? No, probably not, but he would not have been out of place in the middle of the card on that roster. He was a damn good wrestler. I never really fully appreciated him for how good he really was. Until you actually watch his matches back. Even some of those velocity matches, the dark matches, which I wasn't watching Chris Kanyon back then wrestling on Velocity, but you can see this guy was putting the work in, even with the guy's lowest on the rung of the ladder, he was putting the work in, so that aspect of it he had down. Even when he was doing the, who better than Kanyon? You know, he did that in WCW, he did that in WWE when he first came in. I thought he was entertaining. There were a lot of other guys you could probably point to on the roster who were not as entertaining as Kanyon, who had their job. The idea that Kanyon was not good enough to maintain employment in that company because somehow he wasn't entertaining at all is complete fucking bullshit. That's just corporate stooge BS, is all that that is. Now, put yourself in his position. Imagine you're sitting there in studio hearing this. Your idol has called in. You are on national radio, the biggest radio show, one of the biggest radio shows at that time in the country. And you are sitting in studio, you're on video, you're on camera, you're listening to this man in your ear say all of these things about you that just his heart, I'm sure, is just breaking into a million pieces. And years later, he told RF Video in his shoot, he said he almost threw himself in front of a subway train after that appearance was over. He left the studio. He very nearly went from Howard Stern's studio to the morgue. He was suicidal many times in his life. He was suicidal. He was suicidal that day. He had tried previously to kill himself a few times, and he failed. The only thing that stopped him from jumping in front of that train that day, as it pulled into the station, was the fact that his brother was standing on the platform with him. He had his brother with him. He didn't want to traumatize his brother by having to watch that. That is the only reason he didn't jump in front of the train that day. You know, I had never seen footage of Brian Cage wrestling Canyon. I wasn't even aware of the extent of their friendship. Cage was running an indie show at the time. I don't remember what year this was. It might have been 2006 or 2008, maybe something like that. But he brought Canyon in for a match to wrestle him. He wanted to put Canyon over. And Chris insisted, no. This is your show. You're going over. And he did the job for him. And you see the footage of all the people putting Brian Cage on their shoulders. This big celebration. It was a big moment for him. You may have had a crowd of maybe 100 people there. But it was such a big moment for him. It meant so much. And you could see where Cage emulates Canyon in a lot of the moves that he uses in his matches. And even the whole, who better than Cage? Where do you think that comes from? It's an ode to Chris Canyon. Canyon would do it, who better than Canyon? And when he was a heel, everybody would chant back, everybody. So again, I go back to say he wasn't entertaining is just objectively not true. But he wanted to become the first openly gay pro wrestler and was very upset when he heard the WWE was going to be doing a bisexual gimmick on TV with Orlando Jordan, which is something Jordan had wanted to do. And he wrote a letter to Stephanie McMahon, which I'm going to read here for those who have never heard it before. And they showed the letter. I think they showed it briefly on screen. But I have the full text of the letter here. For those who have never heard it, and this is not to put any blame for any of this on Stephanie McMahon. She didn't do anything wrong. But I think it's a good window into where Chris's head was at that time. This is in 2006. This is the letter that he wrote 2 years after he was fired by WWE to Stephanie McMahon. Dear Stephanie, I will try to make this as short as possible, and I am sorry to bother you. 4+ years ago, when I was wrestling for your company, I came up with an idea. You see, I am gay, but at the time I was heavily closeted. My idea was to be the first ever openly gay active pro athlete in the 5 major U.S. pro sports of baseball, basketball, wrestling, football, or hockey. I love how he lumps wrestling in there. I told you, he was a huge wrestling fan. Only a real wrestling fan would lump wrestling in as one of the great top sports in the country with baseball and basketball and football. But that's just how big of a fan he was. By lumping wrestling in with the other four, I thought there was great potential for mainstream publicity. First step was to come out to family and friends, but at the age of 31, that was harder than I thought. After telling just 2 people, I stopped. And I shelved the idea, always planning on going back to it. Well, soon after, I suffered my 2 injuries. First my knee and then my shoulder. Then depression set in. Then I got fired. Depression got much worse. I finally sought help. Through therapy, I came to terms with my sexuality and began coming out to family and friends and really began preparing to meet with your father to give him my ideas and thoughts. I began saving newspaper articles and magazine articles. I began studying sexuality and how it relates to religion and psychology and sociology. To prepare for any potential return, or not return, but any potential mainstream appearances from Howard Stern, Larry King, Good Morning America, The O'Reilly Factor, The Daily Show, Leno to Letterman. I believe and still do, especially with the recent stunning success of Brokeback Mountain, the quote, gay cowboy movie, that there was and still is great mainstream potential. And I wrote ideas for storylines, ideas of how to introduce this aspect of the Canyon character, how to use this aspect of the character to build and advance feuds and storylines, ideas for interviews and vignettes. Then I started taking independent bookings to make sure I would be in shape for when I tried to get the meeting with Vince. I set a time frame of March, number one, to coincide with the Academy Awards in case Brokeback Mountain does well and gets positive mainstream press, and number two, to coincide with WrestleMania, in case the company wanted to introduce new ideas right after the upsurge in interest that always follows WrestleMania. Then yesterday, I read online that Orlando Jordan was going to start a bisexual gimmick. I confirmed this with some current WWE employees. I was completely devastated. My main and at times only motivation for getting out of bed, for training, and for pushing on, this idea to be first, to be a true role model to help young, struggling, confused kids, this idea that I felt and believed to be my destiny, well, I saw it possibly slipping away. So I decided to send this email. I don't want to steal someone's idea or gimmick or glory, but please believe me, I had this idea 4+ years ago and spoke of it with some of your current contracted wrestlers months and months ago. Personally, I feel doing bisexual as opposed to gay is very much diluting the potential. I am also very confident that I am the perfect person to do this, that I can definitely pull off the in-ring work as well as the publicity and mainstream aspects that I feel would help make this a main event character. We only get one chance to be first at something. I would hate to see it diluted and not used to its maximum potential, especially if the only reason was that the company did not know there was someone like me who is ready and comfortable and able to carry the load in the ring and in mainstream appearances, do well, and resent himself professionally and intelligently, or represent himself, I think is what he meant, represent himself professionally and intelligently, already preparing for this opportunity. I truly appreciate your time, and I hope you don't mind me reaching out to you. You were always very nice to me when I worked for you, and I now feel afraid, lost, confused, and desperate. Any advice or recommendations that you can offer would be greatly appreciated. So that was Canyon in 2006. And Stephanie supposedly responded and said in so many words that basically she would have to run it up the flagpole, legal department or whatever. Actually, that's what Jim Mitchell said. And then Canyon never heard back. That was the last he heard from Stephanie or anyone in WWE. And what they did not mention on Dark Side of the Ring is that Orlando Jordan's gimmick never came to be in WWE, because they ended up releasing him. But in 2010, he got to play the bisexual character in TNA. He debuted it on the March 29th episode of Impact. And 4 days later, Chris Canyon committed suicide. He overdosed on his bipolar medication. He left at least one note behind. Now, I am not saying that he killed himself specifically because he saw Orlando Jordan doing the gimmick on TV. Because he had been threatening to kill himself for weeks leading up to this. Things had gotten really, really bad. And he even admitted the last time he saw Jim Mitchell, he was very sore because he had recently threw himself in front of a car trying to kill himself. And Mitchell knew when he flew home, the last time he saw Canyon, I think Canyon drove him to the airport, and he hugged him and he went on his flight. He sobbed the entire way home. And when he got to the airport, his wife picked him up and his wife's like, well, what's wrong? And he said, I think I just saw him for the last time. He was convinced that he was never going to see Canyon alive again. And he was right. So again, he was already in that mental state. He had already been threatening this before. But I have to imagine that, you know, you hear the things he is saying in that letter that he wrote years earlier to Stephanie McMahon, how much it bothered him to see that Orlando Jordan, it could have been anybody, was going to be taking this idea that he felt he already had, and then they would be using it and diluting it, and it really bothered him. And I see that the character pops up on Impact Television, and then 4 days later, he kills himself. I would have to think that him seeing that on TV, it certainly did not help his state of mind. But he was only 40 years old when he passed away. The man was a tortured soul. He just could never find happiness. And even when it seemed like he did, he would just come crashing down. And it's a damn shame because by all accounts, from everybody who knew him, he was so well-liked. The one person who really did not like him was himself. And in the end, it was just too much for him to bear. So I thought it was a solid episode. This week, coming up, they're going to be covering Onita and FMW, which I'm sure is going to be very wild, very bloody, and very wild. So if you are into deathmatch wrestling, this is going to be the episode for you. If you like the Nick Gage episode, the first half of the season, you'll probably enjoy Onita and FMW because he did it first. And I'll be back with a review of that a few days after it airs. Until then, have yourselves a great week, and I'll see you back here real soon. Take care, guys.